I call this meeting of the Property Tax Division to order pursuant to Rule 10.01. The first order of business today is that we need to take a roll call to determine who's present. The clerk, Mr. Peterson, will now take the roll.
Chair Youakim?
Present.
Chair Youakim, present. Vice Chair Gomez?
Present.
Vice Chair Gomez, present. Representative Hertas?
Hertas, present.
Hertas, present. Representative Anderson?
Anderson, present.
Anderson, present. Representative Becker Finn?
Present.
Becker Finn, present. Representative Fisher?
Fisher, present.
Fisher, present. Representative Green?
Present.
Green, present. Representative Hassan?
Hassan's present.
Hassan, present. Representative Herr? Representative Herr, I see you in the Zoom. We'll come back to you. Representative Marquardt?
Marquardt, present.
Marquardt, present. Representative Mortensen?
Mortensen, present.
Mortensen, present. Representative Pawlowski?
Pawlowski, present.
Pawlowski, present. Representative Torkelson? Representative Torkelson. Representative Herr?
Present.
Herr, present. A quorum is present, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. I want to note to all the committee members that the documents for today have been sent to members that are in the committee page on the House website. The first item on the agenda, as always, is to approve the minutes, this time from February 17th. Representative Gomez, have you had a chance to review the minutes?
I have, Madam Chair. I'd like to move the minutes from our February 17th, 2021 meeting.
Thank you, Representative Gomez. Does anyone have any questions about those minutes? Seeing none, we'll move on to a vote. This is a voice vote, so members, please briefly unmute yourselves when you vote. All those in favor of approving the February 17th minutes, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, say no. The motion is approved and the minutes are adopted. I see that Representative Torkelson's now here.
I am. Thank you, Madam Chair. Sorry I'm late. I was tied up with a constituent.
No worries. I find that sometimes it's a lot harder to disengage on Zoom than it is in real person. So I totally understand.
Thank you.
And now, okay, we have Representative Acom here for her first bill in Property Tax Committee, this Property Tax Division this session. The first bill on the agenda is House File 1322. Can I get a motion for Representative Acom's bill to move it before the division?
So moved.
Thank you. Representative Hassan moves House File 1322 before the division. And we have an author's amendment leveled A1. Representative Hassan, would you like to move the author's amendment as well?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Hassan. We have the A1 amendment before us. Any discussion on the amendment? Actually, I'll have Representative Acom. Do you want to just briefly describe the amendment?
Yes, please. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to the committee for allowing me to be here to present 1322 today. The amendment is just a technical amendment that is doing a little tweak to the language to offer more flexibility to the city of Minnetonka, who's we can maybe get to it more in the bill, but it's to provide an affordable housing trust for the city. And so this is just giving them a little more flexibility in how they do that.
Thank you, Representative Acom. Representative Hassan has moved the A1 amendment. Any questions on the amendment? Representative Green.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe you can help me understand that. I was reading the amendment and it looks like you're taking out the up to 15%. So that means it would drop back down to the standard 10%, I believe. And then what does it mean when it says that they're not subject to the annual reporting requirements? And why?
Representative Acom.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Green, for the question. To be fair, It's my understanding, and I do have testifiers here from the city of Minnetonka to be able to say for sure, but it's my understanding that the 15%, it actually allows it up to 35%, and maybe I can look to our community development director, Julie Wishnack, who's here, that could maybe speak to the specifics.
Members, I'll let Ms. Wishnack briefly give an explanation, but I would like to move this amendment so we can get the bill in the shape that the author would like it in, and then we can have all these discussions after testimony. But Ms. Wishnack, do you want to briefly explain?
Thank you, Chair, and Representative Green, I believe, is who asked the question. Really, it is about the 35%, up to 35% under the TIF pooling. It's 25 in some districts, 35 in others, so I don't want to get into the detail of that, but that is the intention, to not go beyond the pooling of each district and place it into the Affordable Housing Trust Fund. Yes, thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Wishnack. Members, why don't we go ahead and move the amendment to get it in the shape the author wants, and then have the testifiers, and then open it back up for more detailed questions. Members, we have the A1 amendment before us. Please unmute yourself. It'll be a voice vote. All those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed? The motion prevails. We have the bill before us in the shape you would like it. Representative Akam, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to the members of the Property Tax Committee for inviting me to present House File 1322, which is a bill to allow the City of Minnetonka to develop an affordable housing trust. One of the many challenges that the COVID-19 pandemic has highlighted is the lack of affordable and stable housing, something we all know is incredibly important and impacts all areas of our life, from health and education to jobs and family. The City of Minnetonka understands how important affordable housing is and has been working for years with developers to offer these housing options. The bill before you today will develop an affordable housing trust and would be one more tool in the toolbox for them to use as they work toward their housing goals. I have two testifiers with me today who can help explain this approach in more detail. First, I will turn to Gerilyn Baroni, Minnetonka City Manager.
Ms. Baroni.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you, Representative Akam. I'm Gerilyn Baroni. I'm the city manager for Minnetonka. For those of you who aren't familiar, we are a second ring suburb in the West Metro, 54,000 plus population, and about 46,000 jobs in Minnetonka. As Representative Akam mentioned, Minnetonka has a long history of trying to provide affordable housing. We have set goals as required by the Met Council, and we have over the years, for many years, 20, 30 years, have been working toward these goals. And really, we are at a point where we wish to continue. We know the urgency. We've seen it, especially in the pandemic, of the importance of providing affordable housing, not just for our residents, but for our businesses that do have employees who come into our community and may wish to live here. And so, as Representative Akam mentioned, this bill relates to an affordable housing trust fund. In actuality, the City Council has already established a trust fund for Minnetonka, and what we're asking for you today is to be allowed to put some of our TIF pooling money into that trust fund. And so with that, we hope you look favorably on that. I'd like to introduce officially our Community Development Director, Julie Wishnack, who can give you a little bit more detail. I know we did have an information sheet. We're not going to go into all those details, but that was in your agenda packet today. So thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Perone, and I apologize for mispronouncing your name. Ms. Wishnack
is fine.
Wishnack, thank you.
Yes.
Ms. Wishnack, go ahead.
Thank you, Chair. I'll just take a couple of minutes here. As City Manager Baroni stated, the city's commitment has been there for some time. And I think unless you are involved in the day-to-day transactional details of some of these affordable housing projects, it might not be apparent to everyone how difficult getting certain kinds of affordability built in a community. I would say the City of Minnetonka has been really successful at building 50 and 60% AMI, or area median income, priced housing. We've been great at that. We just recently finished a 500-unit development that definitely built that kind of unit for seniors and workforce housing. And so we've been really excited to do that. The problem is that some of the tax increment money can only be used for that particular AMI level. And so what we're trying to do is be more flexible. We know that we need a better stratification of affordable housing in the city, everything from 30% to 80% of area median income. And we're just not able to do that the way the laws are set up today. So again, to just summarize, the dollars that would be transferred in the trust fund would be used to create that affordability in a very high construction period for our city. We are building a lot of units right now. Secondly, it just allows that nimbleness that we're looking for to provide the income goals at a variety of points. And then finally, I think what we're trying to do is provide a longer term solution to financing affordable housing in the community. And so with that, Chair, I'll turn it back to you if there are any questions.
Thank you. Representative Akam, anything to add? Otherwise, we'll move to questions.
No, I think we'll stand for questions. Thank you.
All right, Representative Gomez and then Representative Green.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Akam. It's good to see you. I think my question is probably for your testifier. So I guess I'm one thing about TIF, right, is that it does remove money from certain taxing jurisdictions that don't kind of have or potential future money, I guess, right, increment that they that a portion of which may go, for example, to a school district that doesn't kind of get a say over over whether or where TIF districts are established. And so, you know, I for that reason and others, I think, you know, it's an important tool that we need to use really like be really thoughtful about how we use it. And I guess I'm interested in, because in the your comments about the affordability level of the housing, frankly, you know, what we see more and more is, to your point, right, it's much easier to develop housing at 60 to 80% AMI than it is at that lower 30%. And so my concern, I guess, is like about that when we open up funding sources to that higher AMI housing, just that housing is inherently easier to use. And so what it seems like kind of happens is that funding will flow to the area where it's easier to use. And so that's just my only concern is I'm really interested in figuring out how to get a lot more investment at that 30% level, because that's really where the sort of deepest failure in the housing market is. And it's where I believe we need to devote public resources, which unfortunately are scarce, right? We can't do all that we need to do in housing. And so in as much as it's a continuum, when we invest at those very kind of lower levels, it moves folks who would otherwise be in 50% affordable housing down into housing that actually helps them not be cost burdened and then opens up, right, that unit that family moves out of. So yeah, I guess I'm just like, why move the eligibility for the AMI up and not just down?
Ms. Wishnack.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Gomez, I think you make two great points. One is the taking away tax base and taking it away from school districts. I think that's a fair point. My take on it is you're taking existing balances in a TIF district and you're putting them toward affordable housing. You're not creating new TIF districts, which is what happens now. So the minute we can't help a project move forward with affordability, you're creating a new TIF district, you're starting over, you're taking that tax base off, the new tax base that is off the rolls. So I would say to that first part of your comments, this would allow us to not do that, to not set up new TIF districts. The second part of your comments had to do with, you know, why don't you just cap it at what you can do and what you can help in terms of the lower income brackets? I think the problem that we have in our projects is there's just no flexibility. Either you do a tax increment district at 20%, at 50% AMI, or you do, excuse me, my phone, I should have silenced it, my apologies, 40% at 60% area median income. That gives you two buckets. That's it. And so that's not very flexible. And I'm working on a 30% project right now. It's a tax credit project. There's all kinds of, you know, rules and regulations about that. For the city to input any money into that, again, we have to follow those regulations to provide those dollars, which means a new TIF district. And I can't use the TIF pooling balances for that. Long answer to your question, but complicated question too. Thank you.
Representative Gomez.
No, I'm good, thank you. I appreciate the answer.
Yeah, Representative Green.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think part of my question was already answered. I did have another one though. It seems like you're gonna be using TIF funding for some stuff that was allowed at a lower level at one time, but you're creating another or putting it into a bank account that could be completely separate, I believe, from what the funding should have been used for. And the question is, has this been done before? This kind of a, for lack of a better word, switch of the money into a separate account?
Representative Akam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am going to defer to Julie Wishnack for that.
Ms. Wishnack.
Thank you. I think, Chair, it's not apparent, but it happens today. So today, cities can use portions of their tax increment and divert them to affordable housing. So it already happens. I think the difference here is that we're putting it in a trust fund. So say we have, let's just say we have eight. I think we have eight different TIF districts that have some allowance for that to happen. So you would have to track each certain kind of TIF district, what you can do, what the percentages are, instead of just flowing it into this affordable housing trust fund that secures it for the future for that purpose of affordable housing. So I think that's, it might not be apparent because you might not know that cities already do this. It's already part of the regulation that we can spend it on affordable housing.
Representative Green.
Thank you. And I'll just make a comment and then I'll quit in case other people have questions, but that doesn't really answer my question. I know it. I know that you can use an additional 10%, and that's where I got the money. I thought the 15% was actually going to be on top of the 10% that could have been used if you went to affordable housing. So I see where you get your 35%. But it doesn't, I was trying to look this up, and I was busy, so forgive me. I probably didn't look as deep as I should have. But I haven't been able to find a place where they actually created a separate account, and now you're going to be using TIF funds to fund a separate account away from the original funding. And that was my question, if that had ever been done. But I'll keep digging on that too.
No, I would say that is our...
Ms. Wishnack.
I'm sorry. No, I think the representative is correct. We have not done it before. That's why we're asking for the permission. He's accurate in that.
Well,
thank Representative Green.
Well, the people that will be paying this tax, whether now or in the future, should be made aware of that in some way or another, because it's nice to know where your tax dollars are going. And it just seems like it's getting kind of complicated here on an issue where this TIF funding has been used for some time for very good projects. I mean, not saying that the projects that you're putting aside for are not good. I'm not saying that at all. It just seems like it's kind of taking tax dollars and putting them somewhere where maybe people aren't going to know exactly what they're going for. So it might cause a little problem.
Sorry, Representative Akam, would you like to follow up on that, or should I move to the next question?
I think we can go to the next question.
Representative Hertaus.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Akam, Administrator Wishnack. There's been some comments already at the start of this meeting about taking tax capacity or taking property off the tax rolls with TIF. Again, that's not what TIF does. TIF is supposed to pass the but-for test that this tax capacity would have never happened but for creating the TIF district. Madam Chair, with regard to TIF, I'm a little concerned how every year there seems to be proposals to expand the use of TIF. And originally, TIF was intended primarily for economic development, and that's grown into dealing with hazardous substances and soil conditions and renewal and redevelopment. And those are all probably meritorious causes, but I guess I would ask my question to Ms. Wishnock. You mentioned about complying with the Met Council's mandates and their comprehensive plan, their vision of your community, rather than maybe exclusively your vision of your community, but nothing was said or addressed with regard to the quantity of affordable housing in your community. And given the demographics of the city of Minnetonka, given the area median income for the residents of the city of Minnetonka, just how much affordable housing is your goal to be compliant with the comprehensive plan? What percent of your housing units need to be affordable according to the Met Council?
Ms. Wishnack or Ms. Barone, who would like to answer that?
I can start, and if the city manager wants to add. I think that overall, just to give perspective, the city of Minnetonka has 23,500 households of housing. Of that, today, about 21% of it is considered affordable, and that's ownership and rental product entirely. What we're trying to do is not just meet the Met Council goals, because that we're actually doing really well on meeting those goals, and I don't have them in front of me, but the last 4,000 units we built, 22% of them were affordable. I think we can do better, and I think we can be more diverse in the way in which we provide that affordability, and that's exactly what I'm talking about here. So are we doing well on the Met Council goals? Absolutely. Do we need to do more? I do believe we do. So hopefully that helps you with the numbers.
Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that reply. I appreciate that. You know, there is a principle in real estate referred to as highest and best use. And not all areas in all communities are necessarily on equal playing fields with regard to highest and best use with regard to the use of the property or use of the land. Now, it's often been a primary goal of many suburban communities to have what is referred to as life cycle housing, where you have rental property, you have entry-level housing, you have move-up housing, you have larger upscale housing, you have luxury homes, and you even have homes that are created for that time of life when people are downsizing and or looking for retirement. So we have a lot of these different components, but given that there's several aspects to housing and that life cycle goal, it sounds like you're on an ambitious goal to create more than one-fifth of your housing. If 21% of your units are affordable, I'm just wondering if you haven't already met that criteria, but I won't pass judgment on what you folks want to do in Minnetonka, but there seems to be a concern as we continue in state government to create more and more affordable housing at taxpayer expense. We are eventually moving in a direction of diluting the value of everybody else's home. And that is detrimental to your own tax capacities that you have to levy money on. So I think we need to do as much as we can to protect the values of individual homeowners, and being an owner-occupant of a property as opposed to a renter certainly has an advantage of having those individuals who are owner-occupants committed to your community. Having a sense of place and create stable neighborhoods rather than transient ones. So I beg the question amongst the property tax committee that we should be doing more to ensure that home ownership is a priority and that we preserve the values of people that own homes. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hertas. Actually, I have Ms. Stacy, and I'm going to pronounce your last name wrong. I'm sorry, Kavlang, and I've known you for years. Sorry about that.
Thank you, Chair, Representatives. Stacey Quilvang, Ehlers and Associates. I'm the TIF financial advisor for the City of Minnetonka and for St. Louis Park, who's up after this as well. Just a couple of clarifications. First, for Representative Green, the question was asked about moving dollars into their local housing trust fund. Those dollars, if moved into that fund, what you have to understand is that that's a restricted fund under government accounting. So they have to account for that fund separately, and they do have to report on that annually back to the council and to the public. So people are aware of the dollars that are going in there, and cities are having robust discussions about what they're spending those dollars on as they're going through the budget process with regards to their annual budget that they do. The second comment, just to Representative Hertas, I would just do a clarifier. TIF wasn't created originally for economic development. It was created back in the 70s, and it was for housing, it was for redevelopment, and it was for economic development. That's why all the different types of districts came into being back in the early 70s.
Thank you, Ms. Kalang. I always learn something every time I listen to you. I'm going to call on Representative Becker Finn and then Gomez, and then we're going to move on. Representative Becker Finn.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to say, I think for the record and for anyone watching, that I think our priority should be in making sure that every Minnesotan has access to safe and stable housing. My priority will be making sure that our kids, our veterans, our seniors, everybody has access to housing before we prioritize other people growing their wealth. And their equity. And I think that I just want to put that in perspective that, you know, that really should be our goal instead of being overly concerned with others growing their wealth at the expense of other neighbors and people in our community not having housing at all.
Thank you, Representative Becker Finn. Representative Gomez.
Well, I think Representative Becker Finn and I kind of raised our hand on the same point. I do want to, in addition to, you know, the points that Representative Becker Finn just raised, I want to say that we are in an affordable housing crisis across this state in almost every community. We hear from employers in northern Minnesota about the fact that they have jobs, good paying jobs, in their communities, and there is not housing and childcare for folks to move there and, you know, contribute to the tax base in their community because of this housing shortage. And so I don't want anybody to think that that we are in any danger of investing so much in affordable housing that we are bringing down property values. The truth of the matter is that there are an incredible number of families across the state of Minnesota who pay more than 30% of their income in housing expenses, and they're considered cost burdened. There's a bill that Representative Howard has chief authored to provide rental assistance to make that up, and it's $1 billion, right? Like that's the sort of gap that Minnesota families are facing, Minnesota families who rent particularly. So, you know, I just wanted to say that, you know, Minnesota spends less than 1% of our budget on housing. We can and should do more. And so, you know, I think that I really appreciate the fact that we're thinking creatively about how it is that we can increase access to affordable and safe housing for all Minnesotans, because it's really hard to do basically anything in your life if you don't have a place to lay your head. So, you know, that's exactly the kind of thing that we should be doing as policymakers, is ensuring that families and children across our state have a safe and warm place to stay at night. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Gomez. Seeing no further questions, Representative Acom, do you have any closing comments?
I will just, again, thank the committee for giving us the time today for our bill to be heard. And I will just maybe close in saying that I am proud to live in Minnetonka with the commitment they have towards these goals of affordable housing. And I think that we have a city council that is strongly supportive. And I believe in that local control. And so if there's somebody to
turn to, it's the people, the leaders within our city. And so I'm proud of them and the direction they're going, and I'm honored to be able to author this bill. And I ask for your support.
Thank you, Representative Akam. With that, Representative Hassan renews her motion that House File 1322 as amended be laid over for possible inclusion in the division report. And the bill's laid over. And members, since I'm presenting the next bill, I'm going to turn the virtual gavel over to Representative Gomez.
Thank you so much, Chair Joaquin. So the next bill on the agenda is House File 1090 from Chair Joaquin. Chair Joaquin, would you like to move your bill before the division?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to move House File 1090 before the committee, as well as the A1 amendment.
Excellent. Representative Joaquin moves House File 1090 before the division and the author's amendment labeled A1.
Madam Chair. I was just going to explain the A1 amendment.
Oh, okay. Great. Yeah, please explain your amendment.
The A1 amendment actually aligns the language the committee is going to see that just saw in Representative Akam's bill, and we'll see in a future bill that's being considered to make this a statewide approach. What it does is change it. The reporting requirements that are already in the Housing Trust Fund are already there. So trying to track it as a separate TIF once it's transferred would be virtually impossible. So that's why the stronger reporting requirements in the Housing Trust Fund prevail. So that's the amendment, just gets the bill in the order I'd like it. And sorry, Madam Chair, that was a long explanation.
No, that's great. Thank you for that explanation. Is there any discussion to the amendment? Seeing none, if we could unmute for a moment, all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. We have the bill before us. Are you okay with you, Bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This proposal was brought to me by one of the communities I represent, St. Louis Park. St. Louis Park has a long history of implementing policies that support the development of affordable housing and for advocating for policies around affordable housing at the state level. They also have a long track record of trying to stabilize folks in their homes. They have a program that's near and dear to me that stabilizes students in affordable rental units so that they can stay in the same school and not have to constantly move. So stabilizing housing affects many more avenues of, sorry, my brain is not working that well today. It affects many more areas of our government that we fund than people think. Stabilizing housing really does have a direct correlation to kids' academic achievement as well. So that is why I am very proud of what St. Louis Park has been doing around affordable housing. They also work with developers come before the city to include affordable housing in all their projects. They're also one of only 7 cities and 3 counties in the state that currently have affordable housing trust funds as a mechanism to invest in affordable housing, including deeply affordable housing. St. Louis Park did not want to request additional funds for affordable housing at this time, knowing what our economic outlook unsure what our economic outlook would look like, but would rather look for ways to utilize tools already at their disposal in a more flexible manner. And that's exactly what this bill does. Currently, the law allows up to 35% of pooled TIF increment to be used outside the district for housing development, as long as the increment is used for affordable housing. The bill before you allows St. Louis Park to deposit that pooled TIF into their affordable housing trust fund. So it's all in one place and it has more accountability and can be used on both owner-occupied affordable housing as well as rental affordable housing projects. Once the increment is transferred into the city's affordable housing trust fund, the money must be used in accordance to the city's policies that are very public that have been established for the fund. In addition, the funds would no longer be subject then to the annual TIF reporting because now they're in that new account. And with me today, I have Karen Barton from the St. Louis Park Community Development Director, and also who can further elaborate on what this bill would mean to St. Louis Park. Hopefully I caught us up on some time, Madam Chair, and with that, I will turn it over to my testifier.
Thank you so much, Chair Joaquin. Ms. Barton, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and representatives.
My name is Karen Barton. I am the Community Development Director for the City of St. Louis Park. You know, St. Louis Park is a high demand, high end rental market. And really because of that, our ability to create new affordable housing is difficult due to our high land prices. In addition, environmental issues and high construction costs factor into that as well. So back in 2015, the city adopted an inclusionary housing policy, which requires minimums for affordable housing units within new construction in all of our projects that receive public financing from the city. We were one of the very first cities to adopt an inclusionary housing policy, just as an aside. Also, in late 2018, the City of St. Louis Park created an affordable housing trust fund in accordance with the state statutes. And we earmark approximately $1.1 million a year starting in 2021 from our HRA tax levy to fund our affordable housing trust fund. The primary purpose of our affordable housing trust fund is to provide additional to aid in getting units online that are more affordable, more deeply affordable, and in larger sizes to be really appropriate for families. So it's in addition to what our inclusionary policy already requires. Because we all know that to get to that 30% AMI affordability, it takes a lot of investment. It's really a heavy lift on that. So obviously, we all know that there's still a huge demand for affordable housing, especially deeply affordable housing, and we have the very limited resources available for that. As Chair Joachim had mentioned, our request is a creative use of tools that we currently have available that will augment our city's affordable housing trust fund, the funds that we're already putting into that. We currently do use TIF funds for affordable housing to facilitate the construction and preservation of our affordable housing in our city. However, we're simply seeking some flexibility in putting those funds to work more quickly and effectively. So basically, our request with this special legislation is to allow the city to deposit our housing TIF district dollars and redevelopment TIF district dollars, in which the city has elected to retain 35% of the TIF for affordable housing as permitted by state statute, directly into the city's affordable housing trust fund and utilize those funds in accordance with our affordable housing trust fund guidelines for the benefit of low, very low, and extremely low income households in our city. Again, targeted really at getting to those 30% AMI households and larger family units. We're also requesting to be allowed to utilize the 35% of TIF dollars from the non-housing TIF districts for affordable homeownership in addition to affordable rental. Currently, only TIF from housing TIF districts can be used for both homeownership and rental. By allowing us to utilize all of the funds for homeownership, that really expands the amount of funding we have available as for that tool. So basically, by allowing for these minor changes in the legislation, it will allow us to reduce the need for the city to create more TIF districts to achieve our affordable housing goals. It allows us to construct more affordable units faster and more deeply affordable units. It allows us to diversify our affordable housing stock within the city. We're very, very good at doing 50%, 60%, and 80% AMI. We're really needing to plug into that 30% AMI and that affordable home ownership as well. It allows for ease of administration and distribution of funds. It expands our affordable home ownership opportunities, and it really creates wealth building opportunities for the BIPOC communities and other underserved communities as well. So with that, I would stand for any questions that you might have.
Thank you very much, Ms. Barton. Members, are there any questions for the testifier or for the chair on House File 1090? I don't see any right now. Just giving a moment. Looks like we're good. Chair Joachim, did you have any closing comments?
Yes, Madam Chair, and you'll be seeing this language again as well when we bring forward a bigger TIF bill, but I wanted folks to kind of get a flavor of it right now. What I hear the most from my community are those larger family units, too, when it comes to rental. We have a large Orthodox Jewish community that need rental units that are 3-4 bedroom. It's really hard to find those in an affordable price range, and especially with St. Louis Park's proximity to right next door to Minneapolis and jobs. So I want to thank Madam Chair and members today for the discussion. We'll continue to have this discussion. We have all heard the stories in all of our communities about the need for affordable and workforce housing. This is a creative first step that does not cost the state money, and I would like to thank the City of St. Louis Park for bringing forward the idea. Affordable housing trust funds are a valuable but underutilized tool. Maybe by making them more flexible, we'll see more cities jump on board on that. This bill would provide St. Louis Park the flexibility to enhance their affordable housing trust funds so that they can construct more units, diversify their affordable housing stock, and expand affordable homeownership opportunities. Thank you for your consideration, and I would love to have your support.
Thank you so much, Chair Joachim. The chair renews her motion that House File 1090 as amended be laid over for possible inclusion in the division report, and the bill is laid over.
Thank you, Madam Chair. With that, I think I'll take back the virtual gavel and we'll move on to Representative Dabney, who I've seen appear on the screen. We have House File 1066 before the division. Would somebody like to make that motion?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Gomez. Representative Gomez moves House File 1066 before the division. And I believe Representative Dabney also has an author's amendment labeled A2. Can I get a motion to move that amendment?
I'll move that, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Fisher. I probably should have done the other one first. So how we'll do this. First, we're going to move House File 1066 before the division. Any questions on that? So the bill's before us now. Representative Fisher moved House File the Amendment A2 before the division to get the bill in the shape the author wants. I think since we have some testifiers around this, I think we're just going to take a vote on this amendment. And it'll be a voice vote, so it's in the shape the author would like. So people unmute. Any discussion on the amendment? Give it a second.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Dabney.
Good afternoon. Would you like me to just briefly describe the amendment for members?
Why don't we go ahead and do that? Go ahead, Representative Dabney.
Just briefly, the amendment adds counties to the bill as eligible jurisdictions, clarifies that the bill applies only to lodging businesses within the larger tourism and hospitality industry, and ensures that there's coordination of tourism improvement districts in communities across the state. And it was developed with interaction from the hospitality industry.
All right, thank you, Representative Dabney. Members, any questions on the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment's adopted. We have the bill before us. So Representative Dabney, go ahead and start off describing your bill.
Well, good afternoon again, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Gomez. Thank you, Representative Fisher, for having my back a bit there. I do have to start by saying I miss property taxes. As you know, Madam Chair, I chaired this division for 2 years, sat on it for 4, and it's a fun, kind of wonky place to spend your afternoons, and I miss it. Thank you, however, for the opportunity to present House File 1066 today. What we know about the many things that this pandemic has meant to Minnesota is that the tourism and hospitality industry was the first hit economically. and may very well find itself to be the last to fully recover. Some national projections are that the hospitality and tourism industries may not fully recover until at least 2024, an extended challenge for those businesses and for those Minnesotans who rely on them for their employment. We also recognize that tourism drives economic activity across Minnesota, employs thousands of our constituents, and for many people, particularly from out of state, it's the tourism industry that's the face of Minnesota that they find when they come to shop, to fish, to snowmobile, to paddle, to do whatever they might do in our tourism industry. Recently, there was a survey conducted jointly by the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis and Explore Minnesota and Hospitality Minnesota that found that nearly two-thirds of hospitality and tourism industry businesses reported significantly lower revenue this fall of 2020 compared to fall of 2019. Among hotels and other overnight accommodations, however, 87% of the Twin Cities metropolitan area reported significantly lower revenue, 87%. Numbers outside the metro area were also significantly lower, particularly in hotels, but the summer resort and campground accommodations helped cushion the impact in that region, but not blunt it entirely by any stretch of the imagination. For workers in the industry, Minnesota Deed reported in December that in December 2020, that the leisure and hospitality industry saw a 43% unemployment drop from 2019, a 43% drop for those employed in the industry. And the accommodation sector, again, highlighted in this bill, saw a 53% drop in employment rates. I'm pleased that House File 1066, which authorizes a local government to establish a tourism improvement district through a local ordinance process in cooperation with the local tourism industry, should really be called a tourism recovery and improvement district. It's a new concept to Minnesota, but it's not new across the country. There are 18 states that have already authorized tourism improvement districts, some going back as long as 30 years, Madam Chair. It's a statewide bill, particularly with the addition of the A2 amendment that the committee just acted on, modeled after existing law authorizing the establishment of special service districts. The difference is a tourism improvement district is not based upon a property tax assessment, but is a service charge on a lodging night. It's a public-private partnership to provide supplemental funding for specific tourism activities as outlined again in the bill language. No city or county would be required to establish such a tourism improvement district. It's an optional tool for consideration when putting together an economic recovery plan. Members, you should have received two letters of support, one from the Minnesota Association of Convention and Visitors Bureaus, and one specifically from the Arrowhead Tourism Association. You also have a handout with more information about the bill. I forwarded that handout to members in their emails early this afternoon. At this point, Madam Chair, if you would, I'd like to hand it over to testifiers, starting with Sarah Sick.
Ms. Sick.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members. My name is Sarah Pasek with Pasek Capital Solutions, and I'm working with Meet Minneapolis on House File 1066, the bill that will allow the establishment of a tourism improvement district. I want to thank Representative Dabney for his work on the bill. He provided an excellent presentation and walked through the legislation, so I don't have too many comments. But I just want to add that one thing we can all agree on is that the hospitality and tourism industry has suffered significant hits during the COVID-19 pandemic. We've learned that tourism drives economic activity across Minnesota, and when that's missing, communities suffer. Tourism employs thousands of your constituents, and it's often the face of Minnesota. And like Representative Dabney said, while these tourism improvement districts are a new concept in the state of Minnesota, they have not been a new idea in the rest of the country. And we've been looking at these as a way to recover the tourism improvement district, something that has been successful. So just bringing that model here to Minnesota. Massachusetts, in fact, just passed this legislation in January as part of their recovery package. So I just want to emphasize that this is an optional tool for communities to use. And now I'll turn over testimony to Mr. Melvin Tennant and Ms. Anna Tansky, who will provide more details on the bill and how tourism improvement districts will benefit many communities across the state. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Pisick. Mr. Tennant.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. Good afternoon. My name is Melvin Tennant, President and CEO of Meet Minneapolis, our Convention and Visitors Association. And I'd like to thank you for your time today to hear about this enabling legislation in Minnesota for the Tourism Recovery and Improvement District. You've heard that word recovery several times already this afternoon. Tourism Recovery and Improvement Districts, as we've heard, have been around for about 30 years in 18 states and nearly 200 cities at this point. And you can view those on the handout that you should have with you. But they haven't come to our state yet. We do have them next door in South Dakota, where 15 cities, both large and small, have had these districts in place since 2008. And we know that Wisconsin, Iowa, Illinois are states that are considering this as well. A TRID, if I can use that, abbreviation, is designed to be an additive source of funding for a city or county to consider with their hotels, with the hotel community, to attract more visitors, more business travelers, meetings, conventions, and events for the ultimate goal of economic benefit for that community. When we began looking at this for Minneapolis, and that was almost 4 years ago, it was then an eye to drive more business to our hotels, our restaurants, theaters, attractions, sporting venues, and retailers. However, with the onset of COVID-19, many communities are using the TRID as a tool for their recovery efforts. Again, recovery is very important to our industry. The impact to the hospitality industry has been significant due to COVID-19. Hotel occupancy in the state of Minnesota has lagged, the metro area has lagged the national average, and studies show that it'll be 4 to 5 years before our hotel community returns to pre-COVID levels. In Minneapolis, we had as many as 20,000 hospitality employees without work last year at the peak of the pandemic. And we know that the TRID concept was initially brought forth by hotels in our city by some of our hotel general managers that actually worked in other communities where successful TRIDs had been implemented. And they now believe that if enacted, this is a way to bring back levels of business and get workers back to work more quickly in communities across our state. So what are these districts and what do they do? Well, this enabling legislation is based on special service district legislation already authorized in Minnesota. It would allow hotels in a community to place a service charge on a guest room, and that service charge may either be a percentage of the room rate or it might be a dollar figure, $1, $2, or $3 per room night. This would be an additive charge to the guest at checkout. And you've probably paid such a fee in places where you've visited previously. The service would be collected by the district, and it must benefit those who collect the charge. In this case, hotels within the community that set up that district. Because the district collects a service charge and is not and this is not based on property taxes like special service districts, we believe that this legislation is required for communities to develop these districts. If passed by the state legislature, hotels in Minnesota can advance the concept at the local level. They can then vote on acceptance and develop the parameters and uses of the funds. And lastly, approach their local government about the development of the district within their community and through their local ordinance process. So it's very customized to the local community. The uses of the funds are outlined in the legislation, but in general, the hotels will partner with the local convention and visitors bureau to develop new sales and marketing plans or events to drive additional business to the community. An annual business plan developed by the Tourism Improvement Association and executed by the CVB or selected agency for use of the funds and an annual report are all required by the local government when the ordinance is developed. So there are some checks and balances already built into the legislation. The funds must be the funds collected must be used for new or expanded marketing and sales activities and do not replace those dollars that are already provided to the CVBs through the local communities in which they are currently serving. So again, it's meant to be supplemental, not supplanting. The state of Massachusetts, as we've heard, has already passed an economic stimulus bill back in January with TRIP enabling legislation. And we believe this is a way for our state to assist the hospitality industry, and in particular, our hard hit hotel industry, without a financial ask of government or in a line item of the budget. It's a means to get our fellow Minnesotans back to work faster and even to attract more visitors, meetings, events in Minnesota communities that will generate revenue for local businesses and state and local taxes. Lastly, as I wrap up, I would like to add that this legislation has the support of the Greater Minneapolis Hotel Association, Minnesota Association of Convention and Visitors Bureaus, the Minnesota Arrowhead Association, and you should have a copy of their supporting letters. In addition, several other local convention and visitors bureaus are in the process of seeking support from their boards of directors. So again, thank you, Madam Chair and committee members, for your time and consideration on this legislation. And I want to thank Abney for his support of this process. And my colleagues and I would be happy to answer any questions that arise.
Thank you, Mr. Tennant. Ms. Tansky, you're next, but could you keep your comments a little bit more brief? I want to make sure we have some time for questions, so go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will be very brief. In Duluth, we have been exploring the concept
of... Ms. Tansky, my fault. Could you please state your name for the record and proceed?
Yes, sorry. Anna Tansky. I am the president and CEO of Visit Duluth and represent the hospitality tourism section here. In Duluth, we've been exploring this concept of a tourism recovery and improvement district for more than 3 years, long before we knew of COVID or the need for recovery. And while this has been an ongoing discussion, the lodging partners have not made any commitment or decision to proceed further. However, as the pandemic continues and the road to recovery stretches into years rather than months, access to this resource is being considered. These districts are successful across the country, as we've heard, and I want to emphasize that, especially relevant to Greater Minnesota, they are successful in small and mid-sized destinations that have limited budgets due to having fewer lodging properties that are collecting the taxes that fund their sales and marketing efforts. This supplemental funding must be used for new initiatives, and it infuses new visitors, bringing new dollars into these communities. This enabling legislation is the first step to creating a pathway to recovery for hard-hit communities across Minnesota, should they decide it's a good fit for their destination. A majority vote of the hotel owners is required to begin the process that requires several levels and steps, from a local ordinance being formed, customized for that community, and approved by the local governing body, agreements then put in place. These revenues have an immediate impact and provide ongoing opportunities for continued investment and growth managed by the lodging industry in partnership with the Convention Bureau. In conclusion, private dollars being utilized for public benefit, restoring health within the hospitality sector and the overall economy, and moving forward into a thriving visitor economy across Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Tansky. Representative Hertas, questions?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Tennant and Ms. Tansky, for your testimony about this important effort to jumpstart our economy in this sector of employment and jobs. In reading the bill, I noticed that there was kind of a permissive language with regard to what amount of revenue is collected. It referred to a 3% gross tax on entire receipts, which somewhat resembles a provider tax that we've often talked about in the legislature. It also mentions a fee and other reasonable methods of financing, which I guess is open for discussion. My concern is, we already heard that a majority of business owners, 60%, would have the ability to drag the other 40% along with this requirement. Is there any provision for certain entities of certain size or small operation to opt out of the requirement to have to pay these fees, or is there no opting out for anybody who is classified as a business in this enterprise?
Anybody who wants that? Ms. Tansky.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chairman, and thank you, Representative Hertas, for your question. So once this enabling legislation goes into effect, the individual community works within their hotel sector to determine the parameters of the district, including the size of the properties. So for Duluth, we've explored the possibility of lodging properties 30 rooms and greater would be sort of the minimum. And so smaller properties in our community, they would not be impacted. However, they could voluntarily contribute. If they saw the benefit, then they are able to voluntarily participate in this program. So it's up to the individual community to really determine what is suitable for their size properties. If you have only small properties, obviously, then that's going to be a different conversation in a smaller community.
Representative Hertas, follow up.
Thank you. So based on that scenario, perhaps a bed and breakfast who has a couple of rooms may not find an economic advantage to have to pay these fees off their gross receipts or gross revenues, and they would have the ability to not participate. That's good to hear. Also, what about any sunset provision on a proposal like this? I mean, shouldn't you maybe be required to take a look-see after 5 years and see how it's going and whether or not you decide to suspend the operation if it's not working very well?
Mr. Tennant, I saw your hand go up. Go ahead.
Yes, Madam Chair and Representative. The bill does provide for a time limit at which point in time the ordinance would have to be renewed. So there is an opportunity for lots of feedback. In fact, you might also, I'll call your attention to the fact that there is an annual provision for a marketing plan to be presented to the local municipality to make sure that there is always that oversight in place. So this is definitely not perpetual. There is a limit associated with it. It would have to be voted upon by those that are within that particular jurisdiction.
Thank you. And Madam Chair, one last follow-up.
Go ahead.
Thank you. So also with the amendment that was added, it kind of made it appear as though counties would be able to effectively be the operating entity for the marketing. And I could appreciate that with some of the rural counties that maybe that might be a more efficient way. I suppose in a certain way that this then creates competition between counties for competing tourist dollars in terms of wanting to get someone to stay in their county versus someone else. And I could see there being maybe a little bit of issues with that as opposed to specific communities promoting and marketing a destination. And certainly all of us are aware in our travels that you get certain brochures or whatnot to come to a certain community for certain reasons, and this is no different. So I'm not sure how that county connection is. Even if the counties are authorized or enabled, does it still revert to individual communities within the county? Is that what I'm hearing? Or is it that the county would actually be doing all the marketing and make the decisions who's going to participate and who is not?
Representative Dabney.
Madam Chair, Representative Hertas, thank you for the question. I think it's about, generally it's going to go to the Convention and Visitors Bureau in the area, some of which in Greater Minnesota, as you pointed out, may be organized along county lines for the efficiency, as you say.
Representative Hertas?
Thank you, Representative Dabney, and thank you, Madam Chair. I'll end my questioning, but as long as individual participants have the option to not participate or can opt out under certain circumstances, and there are some sunsets, I think that's a bill worthwhile going forward on.
Thank you, Representative Hertas. Members, any further questions? Seeing none, Representative Dabney, final comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Ms. Pasek, Mr. Tennant, and Ms. Tansky for your testimony today. Members, this is an opportunity to provide local businesses and local communities tools to rebuild and recover from remarkable impact of the pandemic on our local economies. It's also an opportunity for Minnesota to put its best face forward through its tourism industry, and that pays off for all of us as residents of this great state. So I ask for your ongoing support as Chair Youakim puts together her division report. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Dabney. And we do also miss you on property taxes. Representative Gomez renews her motion that House File 1066 is amended to be laid over for possible inclusion in the division report. And with that, we are going to move on. And the bill is laid over. And with that, we're going to move on to House File 978 from Representative Becker Finn. Representative Becker Finn, would you like to move your bill before the division?
So moved, Madam Chair. And I do have an author's amendment.
Would you like to explain your author's amendment, please?
Yep. So I would move the A1 amendment. It's adding a requirement for public hearings, public truth and taxation hearings related to the underlying bill.
Representative Becker Finn has moved House File 978 before the division, and now she has moved the A1 amendment. Does anybody have any questions or discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, we're going to take a vote on the amendment. Please unmute yourself. And all those in favor, say aye.
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 All those opposed? The motion prevails and amendments adopted. We have the bill before us. Representative Becker Finn, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So this is the second time around with me bringing this bill forward. This is a bill to allow local jurisdictions to set up special taxing districts for fire protection and emergency medical services. I do want to give most of my time to my testifiers, but will say, you know, of all the different types of taxing districts we have talked about today and in this committee, you know, I don't think there's anything quite as vital as the ability to properly support our firefighters and emergency responders. And we'll remind members that Article 1, Section 1 of our state constitution states that our government is instituted for the security, benefit, and protection of the people, which I think really is the heart of what our fire service folks do. This is a bill that creates efficiency and transparency in the way that local governments are spending on this important public safety resource. With that, I will turn it over to my testifiers.
I have first on my list, Chief Youngman. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members. My name is BJ Jungman. I'm the Fire Chief of the Burnsville Fire Department, and here today on behalf of the Minnesota Fire Association Coalition. We are an organization comprised of four statewide fire associations: the Minnesota Fire Chiefs Association, the Minnesota Fire Department Association, the Fire Marshals Association, and the Arson Investigators. I appreciate you giving House File 978 a hearing and allowing me to testify on the House file. We would like to thank Representative Becker Finn for authoring this important legislation. We believe this bill will help the fire service across the state of Minnesota. House File 978 creates a framework to allow future collaboration with fire service. Currently, there are about 770 fire departments in Minnesota, with over 90% of the staff comprised of volunteers. Fire departments are experiencing a significant challenge with recruitment and retention of staff. At the same time, fire departments are experiencing record high and growing demands for fire service. These challenges are leading to an unsustainable path for the Minnesota Fire Service under its current model. This is an issue in both greater Minnesota and in the metropolitan area. All of this while the complexity within the fire service continues to escalate, whether it's the training requirements or the types of emergencies we respond to. The demands of the Minnesota Fire Service continue to expand. Firefighters, both volunteer and career, must be prepared to respond to these emergencies. The Fire Protection District Bill enables the creation of districts between two or more local units of government who wish to consolidate their fire services. The Fire Protection District is overseen by a board of appointed, elected officials. The regionalization of the fire service under the Fire Protection District allows the fire service to better utilize a scarce workforce. The Fire Protection District can also share specialized equipment and provide more opportunities for staff assisting with recruitment and retention. The Fire Protection District solution is an efficient and effective way to provide an important public safety service in a more reliable and sustainable approach. The Fire Protection District solution is also more transparent, as taxpayers will know exactly what they pay for fire services, as it will be shown on their tax statement separately as compared to being one of the many services covered by the city's general levy today. Currently, there is one operational Fire Protection District established through special legislation in Minnesota, which is Cloquet. The Cloquet Fire District has been very successful since the establishment of their special legislation over 10 years ago. Cloquet has successfully consolidated 5 departments into 1 while providing a higher level of service and more reliable level of service. There are 42 other states with fire protection district legislation. There are many states that effectively provide fire protection utilizing this district model. We have been working with Representative Becker Finn and House Research nonpartisan staff on creating accountable, reasonable, and functional guardrails. We ask for your support, Madam Chair and committee members, in continuing to work with us to pass this legislation authorizing fire protection districts this legislative session. Thank you for your time today, and we appreciate your support.
Thank you, Chief Youngman. Chief Johnson, you're next, and then Chief Speckin on deck. And Chief Johnson, go ahead and state your name for the record and proceed.
Sorry about that, I did not mute. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Dale Johnson III. I'm the fire chief in Tracy, Minnesota here. I am also a board member of the Minnesota Fire Chiefs Association that represents Southwest Minnesota. I would like to thank Representative Becker Finn for authoring this important legislation for us. As a rural fire chief, I have personally experienced the challenges of providing a high quality and reliable fire service to a community. I am also a small business owner as my full-time job. The increasing challenges that are occurring within the fire service, such as recruitment and retention of volunteer firefighters, training requirements, and providing reliable fire service 24/7 with the volunteer staff. Both in my fire department and in my region, we continue to have challenges providing service in a volunteer model. We also continue to have challenges with the current arrangement with being a city department that contracts for service with townships, placing the fire chief in a very difficult spot. As a fire chief, I don't know who will be providing service next year to a particular township. This is challenging when I'm trying to ensure we have the right equipment, right staff, and the optimal fire station location to protect all. The fire district framework will bring all of the stakeholders to the table and give them a voice in the fire protection for their community. It is important that all the stakeholders are given a voice and fire departments have stability in the service expectations. The framework will also encourage departments to work together or consolidate to provide better service reliably together rather than trying to field the crew 24/7 on their own. I believe this framework will better service the citizens and the firefighters in the future. It is much more efficient to provide service together than independently as it is currently done. I would ask for your support in passing House File 978 that is vital to the sustainability of the Minnesota Fire Service. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Chief Johnson. And Chief Speckin, we've saved the best for last. I say that because you're from Hopkins. Go ahead, Chief Speckin, introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Dale Speckin. I'm the fire chief with the city of Hopkins. I'm also a board member of the Minnesota State Fire Chiefs Association representing Hennepin, Scott, and Carver counties. I'd like to thank you today for giving House File 978 a hearing and allowing me to testify. I would also like to thank Representative Becker Finn for authorizing this important legislation. As a veteran of the fire service, I have seen many changes in the fire service over the years. This includes an increasing complexity of fire service and increasing expectations of services and challenges with recruiting and retaining firefighters. Both in my fire department and in my region, we continue to have challenges meeting the demands in our volunteer fire service model. My own department is currently in the middle of a transition to a more staffed model to ensure that we can respond to the request for emergency services within our community. This fire district framework will give Minnesota fire departments a tool in the toolbox to encourage more collaboration and consolidation that will better serve not only their community, but their neighboring communities by working together. This bill will allow departments to consolidate and use their resources more wisely. One department may not have enough volunteer staff available during the day on a weekday, but between multiple departments, they could staff at least one resource to respond to emergencies. Consolidation will also reduce the overhead need to lead multiple departments independently. I would like to thank you for your support in passing House File 978, as it is vital for the sustainability of the Minnesota Fire Service. And thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Chief Speckin. Representative Green, question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I actually have a couple questions. One would be, I'm not sure that, I don't think I'm in favor of this. I served on a town board for many years, and I think that we have good joint powers agreements between counties and cities concerning our fire departments. As far as the funding goes, there's always going to be issues with funding, and opening up another levy is not really, I think, the best way to go. And in comparison, I would say that maybe the author of the bill or one of the, maybe preferably one of the fire chiefs could answer if this would work for you. We also are underfunded in our police. How would this compare to just allowing or the police organizations to start their own levying and be able to levy the cities for their own purposes?
First, I wanted to note in your packets, too, there's a letter from the League of Minnesota Cities. I wanted to note that because we probably won't get much time for any other testimony. That's a letter of support. Representative Becker Finn, did you want to respond or have someone else?
Yep. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I was going to point members to the support from the League of Minnesota Cities and also point out that this is permissive language. This wouldn't be required, but for the communities where this does make sense, this would be an option. This bill is about fire protection districts, but I'm sure if Representative Green wants to introduce his own bill regarding other kinds of special taxing districts, he's welcome.
Representative Green.
Well, I guess that wasn't really an answer, but the problem with the bill is, first of all, I don't believe it's needed, and I think it's going to open a door to starting more agencies, more taxes that are going to be coming at our local folks, and right now. You're going to be looking at the same thing as a property tax. And as you know, as the chair of this committee and committee members, we're already dealing with severe problems in our property tax areas right now. So adding another one, I think, would be probably pretty detrimental.
Representative Becker Finn, did you have a response? I know there were some guardrails mentioned by one of the testifiers.
Yes, and actually, I believe Chief Youngman has a response to one of Representative Green's questions.
Chief Youngman.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Green. As far as it is permissive language, we have tried joint powers, and those have not necessarily worked out well. We've seen those becoming unwound and creating a situation where there's a breakup, and now we have two fire stations that aren't in the right place, and a city has to build a fire station six blocks from where the other fire station was because they're no longer in that district. So the ability to create a fire protection district creates longer lasting relationships in our experience and in other states' experiences to ensure that the infrastructure is planful and that there's a long-term commitment to this, where the contract for service and the joint powers have not shown to be that.
Representative Becker Finn, any follow-up on that?
No, Madam Chair, I think I know we're running out of time, so I know Representative Anderson has a question as well.
Yep. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And if Chief Johnson could answer a couple of questions, and you're kind of from my part of the state, Chief Johnson, so appreciate you taking the time to be with us today. Some of the things you talked about to me bring up the concept of mutual aid, those types of things. And I think about response time. And it used to be that you had to live in town to be on the fire department. How do you see those things changing with this type of an arrangement where you have a bigger geographic area? And how do you serve that type of an area with the what used to be smaller departments?
Chief Johnson.
Thank you, Chairman and Representative Anderson. First question, when I first joined the fire service, you had to, Tracy's a town of 2,100 people, about 4 square miles, not very large. You had to live pretty much definitely within the city limits, and most of them were within 8 to 10 blocks of the fire station. Now, currently, it is within our primary fire protection coverage area that members are requested to live. For myself, that goes as far as 16 miles north of me, 12 miles south, 6 miles to the west, and about 8 miles to the east. Members can live in any part of there. This does make a challenge. One of the other challenges with this is our townships are constantly changing on an annual basis just because different departments are charging different rates for coverage and for fire protection. And then you'll get townships that are changing. Just recently, the township contracts were sent out and we lost 8 sections, which actually I had one firefighter that lived in them sections that we lost that to a neighboring department because they were a few dollars less for fire protection. Next year, they'll probably go up and we'll end up with them sections back. And it becomes massively confusing to dispatchers paging out the calls. It becomes hard to keep members trained and active in your department because they're constantly floating between different departments. Did I answer your question?
Thanks, Anderson. You didn't comment just quickly on mutual aid. Is this kind of a mutual aid on steroids type of an arrangement?
Chief Johnson.
I would not believe this is mutual aid on steroids. You know, our mutual aid is set up depending upon the nature of the call that we have. This is more of helping secure the borders and having the proper equipment in the right areas. Mutual aid in our instance, a lot of times is coming from, you know, anywhere from 10 to 20 miles away.
Representative Anderson, any further questions? Nope. Okay. Sorry, you were on mute. Members, any other questions for Representative Becker-Finn? Seeing none, Representative Becker-Finn, final comments.
Yep, I just thank you for hearing this bill, and I think the amendment makes it a better bill and does help with some of the concerns folks have had in the past. It's a good bill. I will note, too, that this is being carried by Senators Coleman and Nelson in the Senate. It's a bipartisan effort to do right to help our fire departments, and would appreciate your support and would renew my motion to lay the bill over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Representative Becker-Finn. Representative Becker-Finn renews her motion that House File 978 is amended be lay over for possible inclusion in the division report. And the bill is laid over. We have one final bill on the agenda. I think we may be able to sneak in. Let's see how fast people can talk. It's a pretty basic bill. It's House File 500 from Representative Marquardt. Chair Marquardt, would you like to move your bill before the division?
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members. I will move House File 500 for possible inclusion into the division report. And I do have an A2 amendment I'd like to offer this time. I'd like to move the A2 amendment.
Thank you, Representative Marquardt. Representative Marquardt will move the A2 amendment to get the shape and he'd like the bill in. Any questions on the A2 amendment? Seeing none, members on mute will take a voice vote. All those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. We have the bill before us. Chair Marquardt, to your bill.
So thank you very much, Madam Chair. This is an annual bill, a technical bill that is put together by the Minnesota Institute of Public Finance. And it's a number of lawyers, financial advisors, and so forth who look at the bonding authorities for cities and counties and park districts and whatever. And so what is in this bill, and annually what they do, is they will take things out that are outdated or things that are obsolete or for clarification purposes. Basically, if there's ever anything in this bill that someone has an objection to, we look to see if we can fix it. If we can't fix it, we leave it out. So I do have, to get to the technical stuff, I have Rhonda Scobie from the Minnesota Institute of Public Finance here to go over briefly the provisions in this bill.
Thank you. Ms. Scobie.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Marquardt. My name is Rhonda Scobie. I am a bond attorney at Dorsey & Whitney, here today as a board member of the Minnesota Institute of Public Finance. Thank you for this opportunity to walk through the bill today. It is intended to clarify questions that have come up as we work with cities, counties, and other municipalities on their debt obligations and bonds. Starting with section one, and I will try to keep my remarks brief here. Section one is the transportation sales tax. Currently, the sales tax is authorized to be used for, among other things, capital costs of a specific transportation or transit improvement and the operating costs of transit projects and improvements. There have been questions about whether the transportation and transit projects already authorized by the statutes include the related transportation and transit maintenance buildings. The language suggested in this section is a clarification to allow such maintenance buildings to be funded with the existing tax. Section 2 and Section 3, which appear in the amendment, relate to municipal gas agencies. The proposed language would allow municipal gas agencies to engage in electric prepayment transactions. Currently, the agencies have the ability to enter into prepayments for gas, but not electric, while municipal power agencies are currently authorized to do both. For those who aren't familiar with prepayment transactions, in a prepayment transaction of this type, a municipal gas agency or a municipal power agency issues bonds to make a prepayment for long-term wholesale supply of natural gas or electricity, which is resold to local municipalities over the same period. So this provision would allow municipal gas agencies to participate in electric prepays to facilitate compliance with evolving renewable energy mandates over the term of the transaction. Section 4 relates to installment contracts and lease purchases. Existing statute authorizes cities, towns, and school districts to use installment contracts and lease purchase agreements. However, the portion of the statute that discusses how to treat such contracts for the purposes of calculating the debt limit only mentions lease purchase agreements and is silent on installment contracts. So the proposed language would add installment contracts to that portion of the statute as well and treat both types of contracts in the same way, by excluding both types of contracts from the calculation of net debt if the amount is less than $1 million. Section 5. Currently, Minnesota statute 475.56 relates to the interest rate, original issue discount, and other technicalities of municipal debt, but it uses outdated and undefined terminology and has references that render portions of the statute very difficult, if not impossible, to interpret. And this has led to inconsistent application and interpretation across the industry of this portion of the statute. So the new language that is proposed We believe provides a more straightforward method to calculate the components that are factored into the interest rate. Skipping ahead to section 7, that deletes a cross-reference to the language that is changed by this section 5. Getting back into the order of things, section 6 deals with street reconstruction. Currently, the law states that street reconstruction includes not only the streets themselves, but also the improvements related to the streets that have a substantial public safety function. Many bond council have traditionally interpreted this language to allow the use of these bond proceeds for bicycle lanes, sidewalks, and paths that are incidental to reconstructing the street, as those types of amenities are believed to have a substantial public safety function. But we thought a clarification here to make that explicit would be helpful for practitioners in this area. Section 7, we touched on with section 5.
Ms. Scobie, we've got just 2 more sections left and we are allowed to go 5 minutes over and we have 4 minutes left. So could you just briefly describe the last 2 sections? Thank you.
Certainly. Thank you. Section 8 is escrow securities. There are some outdated terms. There are some categories that no longer exist, and we've updated the terms to the currently existing categories. And then the final section 9 relates to port authorities. In present law, there are 2 sections that deal with how port authority property is disposed. They're contradictory. We've suggested striking the shorter, less detailed version and keeping the more detailed provisions.
Thank you so much, Ms. Scobie. Members, do we have any questions for Ms. Scobie or for Chair Marquardt? Chair Marquardt, final words.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members, and thank you, Ms. Scobie, for going over the bill. Members, this is the Public Finance Annual Bill. If you see anything as you look through this bill further that you have questions on, please get back to me. I want to work this out so there's not anything controversial. It's strictly technical. So with that, Madam Chair, I'd like to renew my motion to lay over House File 500 as amended for possible inclusion into the property tax report.
Thank you, Representative Marquardt. Representative Marquardt renews his motion that House File 500 as amended be laid over for possible inclusion in the division report, and the bill's laid over. Thank you for your work today, members, and all of your questions. Next week, we'll be meeting on Wednesday, March 3rd at our normal time. And then again on Thursday, March 4th at 1 p.m. during the tax time slot, courtesy of Chair Marquardt. We will be beginning our journey into the wonderful world of local option sales tax bills. So until then, we are adjourned.